Welcome back to another episode of the Golf Coach Podcast. I'm your host, Toby, a PGA professional golf coach, lucky enough to teach tour players all the way through to beginner golfer, these days mainly through online coaching. On the podcast, I'm very lucky enough to share conversations with my friends who are from PGA Tour players, live golfers, you know, all the tour coaches, fitness experts, mental coaches, and many, many more. I'm extremely passionate about golf coaching, and I'm extremely passionate about health and well-being, and hopefully through these conversations with my friends who are experts in their field, that we can bring these two together to help better your game, better your health, have a bit of fun, and educate you along the way. If you like what you hear on here, please don't hesitate to follow us on our socials. All the links are below: TM Golf Instagram page, The Golf Coach Podcast, and many more. Thank you very much for listening. But before we get into it, the major sponsor of this podcast is Skillus. Download the Skillus app today. Use code TOBYM at the checkout for 20% off any lesson package with any golf coach on there. That's included in the monthly subscription plans. And for coaches, download the Skillus app today. Use code TOBYM and you'll get your first 2 months free to start your golf coaching journey online today. Let's get to the episode. Welcome to the Golf Coach Podcast, everyone. Today, I have a good friend of mine, Dominic, as a party on tour coach. If you guys listen to the podcast a lot, you guys would have heard a lot from Dom. He was my first guest. I had him on recently and we touched base, and I've caught him while he's sitting still in sunny Queensland. I thought, let's get him on. And I've also got a good friend of Dom's and Lucas Herbert's caddy, Nick Pugh, but I think he goes by the name Lush Beard. I mean, Pewy, I think, is more often than what he's kind of what he's called about. And if you guys have watched Lucas Herbert play, I think it's pretty hard to miss Lucas's caddy art. That I'm really glad to have you guys on, mate. Thanks for coming on, guys.
Thank you. Good to be back again, mate. And as I said, I've got Pewy with us for a few days before we head over to live Adelaide. And too good an opportunity to not do this podcast and share it with this great man sitting beside me.
Yes, exactly. I had this, like, as soon as Dom was like, let's get Pewy on here, and I was like, oh wow, great, I've got to do some research into this guy, and he's a little bit of a myth, aren't you, Pewy, mate? Have you spent much time in Oz?
Yeah, quite a bit. Probably not as much as I'd like to be honest. My wife and I have been here several times on holiday, dating back for years and years. And then once I hooked up with the Herbert clan, yeah, I've been over a fair bit. We've come over. Generally, there's a few events in Oz towards the end of the year each year. And then, yeah, even back in the early days when we used to come over and have some sort of training camps and stuff like that. So there's not as much golf in Australia as I'm sure we'd all like, but any time there's golf being played here, then, yeah, we're all here in a heartbeat.
So you're from England, right?
Originally? Yeah, northwest of England, near Hoylake, Royal Liverpool, where the Open was last year, where little Brian Harman swam his way around to a victory in last July, yeah.
Geez, he did well. I tell you what, Pewy, it's interesting you say that, because I'm now reminiscing a little bit, where a friend of mine, Ben Loffrey, was in the English amateur team, and they used to come out every summer. And he'd come crash with me and at my golf course, Longreef Golf Course at the time, and they'd spend a couple of months out here at a time, I think it was. He would spend out here and play all the events, all the amateur events. Is that when you're coming out here, kind of like with that crew, or?
No, I mean, I only started coming out here other than on holiday once I joined Team Herbert. So
okay.
I think that was the end of 2019, was it? Or 2018? I can't remember. Yeah, it's been a blur, shall we say.
It was 2019, I think. I did the research.
Okay, 2019. So yeah, I think I came out for the Oz PGA was our first event. We actually did a couple of pro-ams at Nyanga and
Axdale.
Yeah, we did a couple. Yeah, Lucas played really well there last week and won them both, probably because I wasn't on the bag, to be fair. But I remember coming out and doing those first two pro-ams and just being blown away by the support that he had locally, which was really nice. And then, we did the Oz PGA, and then, away we went, traveling around the world.
That's awesome. Wait, before we get started into it, where did you holiday in Australia? Because it's a big place.
It is, and I've been to Perth, which I know is sort of rumoured to not even be part of Australia. It's that far away.
They tried to.
Yeah, we did the usual down Margaret River, tasting some wines and that kind of stuff. And then I did a road trip with the missus, I'm going to say from around that area again, all the way up the West Coast, a fair way up as well. Like, we got a camper van and did the usual tour thing, and that was great. I mean, Oz is probably, as much as I travel around the world, Oz feels the most home other than being in the UK. And all my UK friends and relatives now will hate me for this, but it's like a better version of the UK. It's like the UK with nice weather and still with meat pies and sausage rolls and, all the good things that we have back in the UK.
I would agree with that. My best mates in Manly when I was living up there from the UK. two of my groomsmen at my wedding were from the UK. So they're actually Aston Villa fans. So they're a little bit excited these days. But, mate, I guess before I want to ask you some questions, especially about you guys working as a team, because there's some really cool experiences you guys have had and some success you guys have had. Pee-wee, I think one of the things I always am interested and intrigued to learn about is how a player or a coach or whoever it is, and how a person becomes a caddy, and then that relationship kind of with that player, because it's not one of those things where, you know, people might start playing golf and they go, I want to be a coach. I'm not really, I want to be a player first and then a coach and then maybe golf operations. Caddy is never really like on the job list, right? And I'm always interested to kind of feel like, how did you get into being a caddy?
Yeah, I mean, same exactly what you just said there. I played for many, many years. Not well enough, but I mean, I didn't even have a caddy myself when I played back in the early days in the UK. It was only when I came out to Asia and had another go at playing, and then I had sort of a couple of caddies, mainly local guys that were sort of, you know, looped for me, with not great experiences, you know, guys who were just jumping on and off the bag on a weekly basis. But I started to realize the importance of having a good caddy then when I was playing. And then coming towards the end of my playing career, I kind of just sort of a couple of friends asked me if I'd fill in. Almost a bit sort of embarrassed to ask me, because they were kind of like, oh, look, you know, I hate to ask you, but could you just come and caddy for me this week or that week?
Interesting.
And I started filling in a couple of weeks here and there and really, really enjoyed it. Like it was the same challenge of getting around a golf course, but without the same responsibility of hitting the golf shots, if you will. And I feel like I always had the skill and the ability to see the right shots and to have the course management and the preparation and all that side of it. I just wasn't that good at executing, you know, the desired shot. So, yeah, I did a couple of sort of just impromptu fill-in weeks here and there. One at the European Tour qualifying school in Italy, one in European Tour school in Spain. And these were kind of dripped out over a couple of years. And then I was just kind of at a loss of what to do. I'd played, I'd coached. I'd done some stuff in the retail space, and I was just kind of looking for my next challenge and not really knowing what I was going to do as a career, really. And just took a trip out to, actually it was Australia. Yeah, here we go, full circle. I came out to Oz for the Oz, I think it was the Western Australian Open at a Greg Norman course somewhere. No, it was like something Cutters. Anyway, and mm-hmm. I did a week for a buddy of mine there. Jamie Sadlowski was in the field. And then because I was in Oz, another friend of mine, a fellow pro from Malaysia, hit me up and said, hey, are you in Australia? I'm playing the Oz Open next week. Do you fancy caddying for me there? And I was like, oh, yeah, okay, why not? And this is what happens within the caddying world. I quickly realized was that if you're in the right place at the right time and you're not, you know, a complete drongo that drops a towel every three holes or loses stuff, then your services are required. It seems to be more players than there were good caddies. So I ended up filling in that week at the Oz Open, which was great. Saw Jordan Spieth, Adam Scott, all these great players playing. And that really whet my appetite then. I was like, hang on, this is actually pretty cool. Like, you know, again, back to that sort of feeling of not feeling the same pressure of hitting the shots and being able to actually enjoy walking along inside the fairway, inside the ropes, you know, enjoying that process. So, yeah, just stumbled into it that way for a few friends.
It sounds like it kind of matches your lifestyle as well, like the way that you like to holiday, you know, on the West Coast, up a camper van type of style. And I guess it's, I'm not going to use the term gypsy, but you're kind of doing a lot of travel, right, and getting around. So it seems like it kind of suits you. To me, I think there's, you know, I think the more people get into golf, the more people spend around tournament players, the more you can see the skill that's involved in being a professional caddy. And I know myself, I have some of the attributes, but I definitely don't have some of the attributes. I feel too much to the point where I was just extremely nervous. Like, what attributes do you think that you have that are good qualities that are kind of, you know, got to get your little ego hat on here, right? And kind of tell me why you're good at it. But tell me, why are you good at a caddy, and what have you evolved and changed since coming out and to now? Like, how have you evolved?
Yeah, great question. I think the easy answer is the sort of organization and the you know, I mean, Lucas sort of takes the mickey out of me, says that I'm OCD, but I'm neat and tidy. I like things in a certain order, but that doesn't just mean my socks folded up and my high tops matching my shirt that day. It's from a mental perspective as well. Like, everything's sort of ticked off and organized and you know, very much sort of scheduling and that kind of thing. So I'm a big sort of box ticker and sort of doing things, you know, the right way, if you will. So that, again, it's not OCD. OCD is walking into a room and, you know, flipping a light switch on 47 times before there's attributes or there's parts of that sort of liking. I think someone said about liking being in control of the controllable. So I'm very good at getting all the stuff that I'm in control of in order.
Yeah.
And then I can turn up and effectively then Lucas doesn't have to worry about whether there's any teas in the bag or, you know, how much peanut butter's on his sandwich, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I do all that sort of easy stuff, but it's also time consuming stuff from his perspective probably. And then, you know, you can go a level deeper then where, you know, I'll know what's left of that fairway bunker, you know, if we, you know, take too much off the corner on this, you know, dogleg par five type thing. So I always enjoyed looking at and studying golf courses, and that's just got to the point where it's almost at a perverted level now where I'm, you know, I'm never happier than when I'm walking a golf course at 7 o'clock in the morning on my own, making notes. And it sounds cheesy, but being absorbed in nature and just walking around when there's no one else there, that's actually, you know, part of my favorite part of the job.
That would give Lucas a fair bit of trust though, right? Like obviously he knows that how, I'm going to use the term, I guess, deliberate or pedantic that you are about certain processes that are put in place, where he's got that sense of, oh, everything's okay. Pewee's here. Pewee's got this organized and stuff like that. Did you notice in Lucas's demeanor at all, Dom, when, obviously talking about Lucas Herbert here, right, but his career and Pewee's his caddy, but did you notice in Lucas's demeanor at all, Dom, when Pewee came on, that something changed and some of the attributes that Pewee brought to the team? Because obviously you guys have had some success, right? You've had two, is it two DP Tour wins? Have you had Pewee and a PGA Tour win with him?
With Lucas, oh sorry, Lucas, with I, we won the Irish Open.
Yes.
We won in Japan, PGA Tour, and on the PGA Tour Bermuda, yeah. So we've had four wins together, a couple on the DP World Tour, sorry, three on the DP World Tour and one on the PGA Tour.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, some of the attributes that I see with Pewee is just his work ethic, Toby. He's so prepared. And I think the other thing I love and see a lot with Pewee, and I see it in great caddies, is they're nearly emotionless on the golf course. It's like, I think as a caddy, the worst thing you want to be is a cheerleader. And I see that a bit in caddies. And it's like, hang on, it's not your role. And in fact, the best you can be is less emotional around the player, because you don't want that player, you know, riding the highs and the lows. You just want them, you know, really regimented, every shot's the same thing, whether it's a first tee ball in a 72 hole event or a, you know, 7-9 into the 71st hole. It's like it's just a shot. And I think that's a really important attribute of a caddy. I think Pewee's just really evolved in so many ways. So when you ask that question about, you know, Pewee's influence on Lucas, I think they've both matured, evolved, learn a lot about their line of work and how they work together. I mean, Lucas is 28 now. You know, if you've been in the bed 5 years, he was, you know, 23, pretty young.
Yes, yeah.
Pewee was fairly new into it. You know, the first time I heard you're in Singapore on Jazz Jane's bag, probably hadn't been doing too much. So I think as a team, Toby, we've all sort of grown and learnt together, whether that's around the role of the caddy, the player and the coach. And we all support each other so much in that, you know, in that development. You know, Pewee and I talk nearly every day, you know, and it's all just based on how we can make Lucas better.
Yeah.
How I help Pewee in any way doing his job to the best of his ability. He's my eyes and ears out on the golf course. He's always talking to me around, you know, what language is being spoken, what shot they were trying to hit. So, you know, as a coach outside the ropes, you know, someone like Pewee inside the rope and communicating with me after rounds, you know, and sometimes I'm not even in that country, you know, we're speaking to each other, you know, these are what I saw, these are what I noticed, you know, and we're so good, the two of us, around his tendencies, you know, and understanding when he plays well, why, when he's struggling, why that could be. So, I mean, we're just a great team in that respect.
So that, I mean, that takes time, like in any relationship, that takes, you can't fast forward that process. Unfortunately, you have to learn from mistakes. But I think you touched on a point there that kind of there's very different dynamics within the professional golf world. You know, sometimes you'll have a very young and experienced player with a very long in the tooth, you know, great caddy that's been around the block and all that. And that's often applauded as being the right way to do it, is to bring this person of huge experience in to come and shepherd the young golfer around. But sometimes I feel like that's almost too much of a power struggle. There's almost just too much influence there from one side.
Yeah.
And then you could look at it the other way, where you'd have a 20-year veteran on tour who was brilliant, and he'd have a caddy that hadn't caddied before very much, and then that would be too much of a power struggle the other way, where there would be too much assertiveness from the player and no input from the caddy. And I think, look, certainly within professional golf, one thing we all know is that there's so many different variables. There's not one way to do it, not one cap fits all. Look how Scotty swings it compared to Adam Scott, compared to whoever. It's there isn't a right or a wrong. And all I'm waffling on about here is it just happened to be that Lucas and I were both relatively new to our career paths, and we kind of have learned along the way together. And that's, I'm not saying that's the right way. It just is the way that we've developed as a team, which is, again, not the norm, maybe, or not always the norm, but just a freak set of circumstances.
Yeah, we just get on so well as a team. Piri, one of my best mates, I turned 50 just before Christmas, and Piri and his wife came out from Korea for my birthdays, Christmas. And, we're spending so many weeks together on the road that, the support we all have for each other within the team, whether that's Piri and I as coach caddy, or, caddy Cronin as a physio, or, we're all there looking out for each other, making sure that, there's always difficult times on the road that, it's great to have support around each other and around the team. And, I think we're so fortunate with Team Herbie, that we all get on so well and support each other. And, I think a lot of the success that he's having and had, and, hope that gets to the next level moving forward, is, a process of how we all work together. Jonah Oliver works with Lucas on the mental side, talks about ninjas. You want a team of ninjas. We're all just absolute ninjas at what we do. There's no stone unturned. And I actually like that term, that, if you surround yourself, if you create a team that is full of ninjas, it gives yourselves the best opportunity. And, I think to any aspiring young professional wanting to forge a career in golf, I would encourage them to, probably the most important thing is to build the right team around themselves of absolute ninjas.
Yeah, I would agree. Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree with that anymore. Well, mate, I would say that in everyday life, surrounding yourself with people that, are not only doing, we want them to be not, I call them, what I, through my studies, is called energy vampires, right? People who are just taking your energy and sucking you out and just leaving you out in the lurch. And you want to make sure that people around are all contributing, and you don't feel like you're always having to try and help this person, and it just becomes too hard after a period of time, right? So if you're all pulling your weight. But there's one thing there that you mentioned there, Pewee, right? And about the, I reckon there's been a big evolution in golf that probably hasn't been spoken about a lot. And one of those is the caddy type and the player, where it used to be like you said, a fresh player would get an old school caddy, and that's what he needs. That's what he needs. Well, it's interesting because now you see, well, probably about 5-10 years ago, where we saw Dustin Johnson, I think, get his brother on, and then we saw Jason Day get his mate on, and then you started to see that a lot of these, and like Rory McIlroy, like all these guys were just getting their buddies, people who they had that good relationship with. Because I think when I want to be optimizing my performance in any state, I want to be surrounded by people who are like-minded, people I get along with, people I love, and I'm going to be playing quite well. It doesn't matter if this guy hasn't been on tour for 20 years and knows what that blade of grass over there, because that's not going to actually fucking help me swing the golf club. I need someone next to me who's going to make me feel good, right? And comfortability. So there's definitely been a big shift, hasn't there?
Oh, definitely. You can see it. I mean, I think that happens in a lot of careers and job roles. But yeah, as the game has become, and without being crude and talking about financially, I think as all sports become worth more money and the prize money goes up and the pressures and all the rest of it change, I think everything, every sport at every level is becoming more professional, if you will. So yeah, the guys coming on board, a lot of the young kids in America, a lot of the tour players around the world are bringing their mates on the bag, but yeah. They're generally from the same background. They've generally played on the same golf team together, or they're ex-pro themselves. They're not just complete noobs who don't know anything about the game
of course.
All. they're usually pretty damn good golfers themselves.
Yeah.
And they understand then that, okay, well, you're trying to hit that shot because, yeah, that's what we used to hit 10 years ago when we played college golf together and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, it's definitely – I've been saying it for a while and I've been conscious of not sounding like I'm criticizing the old school caddies, if you will, the guys who've been around for years. But there does seem – it does feel like there's been a bit of a changing of the guards of late. But also as the reputation of the caddy sort of gets cleaned up a little bit, so that there's fewer chain smoking, heavy drinking, overweight guys who are out there, you know, not turning up for tea times, that kind of thing. You know, that was the old fashioned sort of view of a caddy. It was never seen as a professional career, which is why, you know, you say like no one grows up wanting to be a caddy, but potentially that will change in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. Kids coming into the game, and I've seen it on tour where there's younger and younger guys coming into caddying because, not just, again, from a financial perspective, but they're seeing that it is actually a career path and there's this gap for professional, you know, like-minded individuals who are in it for the right reasons, not just to travel around the world and get, you know,
get shit-faced, you know, everywhere. You
know, 10 minutes, yeah.
One of the major sponsors of this podcast and the biggest supporters of this podcast is Skillist. You guys all know that I do majority of my coaching through Skillist. And today we are lucky enough to be with one of the co-founders, Baden Schaff. How are you going, Baden?
I am great, Toby. It's awesome to be here.
My question to you is that, what is Skillist? Why does Skillist exist?
Skillist exists because after 20 years of teaching this game, I got a little bit sick of students not getting good fast enough. So what we did, me and my co-founder, we set out to build a platform that allowed students to interact with any coach from anywhere around the world. So this completely changes things, obviously, because now students aren't tied to geography. They don't just have to see the person down the road. They can work 24/7 with the best coaches in the world and the coach that's perfect for them. So they do this using video sharing, video analysis, Zoom calls, voice and text messages. And it really is just an open line of communication through your phone with the world's best coaches.
I like this. And it just gives the ability, so it's different from, I guess, the generic one-off lesson where, you know, what I like about the platform is that, you know, I stay in constant contact and it'd be unusual for me to not be with talking to my students 3 to 4 times a week. That's a bonus, right?
That's a huge bonus. So this is the thing is that, you know, you and I both know that really the answer is in the conversation, and the conversation with your student has to be super fluid. It has to be happening all of the time to really, really get to the crux of most of their.
I love it. It's definitely away from the transactional experience from the in-person coaching and what I talk about making permanent sticky changes. Now, does Skillist have an offer for us today, mate, for coaches and students?
Certainly. Certainly. Any student out there that wants to learn from one of our world-class coaches can just use the code TOBYM at checkout. Make sure you do it at checkout and you're going to get 20% off any lesson package or first month of a subscription. So we would love to see you there on Skillist.
And what about for coaches? We got anything available for them?
That's a good one. Yep, we can absolutely offer them 2 months free usage on the platform when they first sign up to the app. So all they need to do is sign up and then get in contact with us and we can sort them out.
Great. So for coaches who are willing to jump onto the platform, I'll put the link below for you to be able to contact Baden as well if you want to jump on. 2 months free. You heard it here at the Golf Coach Podcast. Mate, thanks for being one of the major sponsors.
Always a pleasure and love your work.
Hey, tell me, all right, let's switch up a little bit. When I had Dom on episode one, the most I've ever laughed on a podcast since, we spoke about that he used to do bets with Herbie on the golf course. So bets around about having to eat a chili and things like this. Do you partake in these types of bets?
Yeah. I mean, they go on. Again, it's cutting your cloth accordingly. It's knowing your player. It's knowing your individual as to how you stoke that fire and how you – I don't want to give away too many secrets here because if Lucas listens to this, he'll get wise very quickly. But again, over a period of years, Dominic and I have figured out how to stoke that fire, if you will. So you know, certain players need encouragement. They need an arm around the shoulder at times, and Lucas is no different. But then there's other times where it's almost laughable, where you can say, ah, mate, there's no way you can pull that off. Like, there's no way, there's no way you could do that. And it's just, you can see the spark in his eye, and you can see the fact that he's just bitten that big juicy worm on the hook. And Dom's way of doing that is with these chilly bets. But yeah, there's barely a day goes by where Lucas and I aren't gambling. And it's not financial normally.
Yeah.
It's just a daft bet. Like, he gets to pick my socks or what colour shoes I wear. Or I think there was a picture of me years ago carrying a golf bag down the fairway with a bag above my head.
Yes.
As a punishment for getting a yardage wrong, which thankfully I don't do too often. But yeah, it's, again, it's finding different ways to keep your player motivated.
And yeah,
it's no more sort of sinister than trying to have a bit of fun. And I think, you know, professional sport gets a rap of you're not allowed to be having fun. You know, if you seem to be sort of smiling and laughing and joking walking down the fairway, well, you're not taking it seriously. Well, I can assure you, we take it as seriously as any other team out there. But on those, you know, 95% of your time on the golf course is spent walking down the fairway in between shots. So
yeah,
we fill those times with, yes, some very, very silly bets.
Well, it's funny you talk about having a laugh and being relaxed on the course, because I'm a big component of it, I truly believe, because like I talk about that optimizing performance, right, and the situation that you're kind of feeling. But I don't get to watch a whole lot of golf, but I watched the Masters final round because I actually worked on that Monday because I just flew back in. And that, I'm going to get his name wrong, because so much golf I don't watch anymore. Ludvig Åberg, whatever his name is. I think he came second or third in the Masters or something.
Ludvig Åberg,
yes. Yeah, apologize for him butchering his name. I'm sure he's an avid listener. But I watched him in the bunker on the last hole. And, you know, it's a fair bit on the money. You know, when you're coming down the stretch, like second, third, fourth, obviously players aren't stupid. There's a ton load of money. That's when they're probably only time they're maybe thinking about it. I don't know. But like there. And he was just getting into the bunker and his caddy said something. They were just kind of laughing. And I thought, wow, this is a young fella, 72nd hole of the Masters, and he's in such a relaxed state. And I looked at it and thought to myself, there is no wonder this guy is reaching his potential at these levels, because he seems so comfortable and at ease being in that position. And I just watched someone like a Scottie Scheffler play at the moment, and he seems like he's just in that state all the time. Where, I'm not saying he's extra happy, and but he doesn't look like he gets around the golf course with the weight on his shoulders, if you know what I mean. Like, he looks like he's ready to play well. What do you think about, you know, have you met his caddy before?
Are you talking about Ludvig or Scottie?
No, Scottie Scheffler's caddy.
Yeah, I mean, Teddy Scott's one of the nicest human beings on the planet. I don't possibly find anyone who would say a bad word about Teddy. He's just like you said before, he's the opposite of a energy vampire. He's just so beamingly happy and smiley whenever you see him. But yeah, there's a huge amount of really good guys out there on tour carrying golf bags around, and Teddy's a very, very nice, humble human being who I think was going to retire before Scotty gave him the call to come out and sort of fill in for him for a little while. And yeah, there we go. And again, like we talked about, sometimes that match works. Like, Teddy's a very, very experienced guy. Scotty was relatively, not inexperienced, but underperforming, should we say. He had one on tour. And that's an example of how that dynamic absolutely worked. You know, that experienced caddy sort of, was he the difference that made Scottie Scheffler suddenly become the number one, you know, ball striking machine in the world? Who knows? But I'm sure they're both enjoying the ride while they're going along finding out.
Toby, I can't believe you asked, does Puri know, like, these people? Do you not realise this guy, like, you go to majors and things, like, these, not just the caddies, mate, the best in the world, they just want to be around this guy.
Oh, come on, stop. Like,
do you know Teddy Scott? I mean, Teddy Scott and Puri and the list goes on. Like, it's legendary, this bloke.
Interesting.
Teddy's got four green jackets. I say not four green jackets. Teddy's got four flags from Augusta. Teddy's in a different stratosphere than I. But yeah, I've been very fortunate that with Lucas traveling around the world, we've played in some tournaments and been to a lot of majors. And you get to spend time around these guys, which is great for me, because I'm still relatively, despite the Santa Claus beard, I'm still relatively inexperienced in the golfing world. I've been doing this for, you know, 6-7 years.
Yeah.
And some of these guys have been out here for 20 to 30 years. So I'm always very, very keen to try and, you know, I'm like a sponge around these fellas. I'm always sort of asking questions and trying to figure out what can I do to fast forward my progress, because I haven't got another 30 years, you know, in caddying, unfortunately, unless they invent some seriously good anti-aging pills.
Or you can take golf.
So I'm just trying to cram in years of knowledge into my sort of short caddy. So guys like Teddy are great to be around. And Joe Scovern, who you mentioned there, working for Ludwig, is also, again, you know, worked for Ricky for years. And
yeah,
these guys all learned a huge amount over a long period of time. So I try and sort of study is a glamorous way of putting it, but whenever there's an interaction between a caddy and a player on TV, I'm always telling everyone to shut up and turn the volume up, because I want to hear how things go down. I want to hear how the information is delivered, the inflection, the voice, the timing, and I'll micro-analyze every conversation on the golf coverage to try and learn something. You know,
it's interesting
of the opinion that I haven't learned anywhere near as much as I need to yet.
What do you think, Dom, about Scotty Scheffler right now? Like, I'm under the impression that people are just sleeping on what's happening right now. Like, we've had some incredible good golfers, you know, over the last, you know, since the Tiger domination, right? Like a Rory, Dustin, you know, Spieth, you know, Justin Thomas up there for a while, like John Rahm. But I'm just seeing with Scotty, and I know he hasn't got all the majors as yet, because he will collect them, I'm sure about that. I reckon we're just about to witness the best since Tiger. I don't know. I could be like, it's, I think people are sleeping on just, if you go look at his world golf ranking and just see what he's doing, like you have a look at the, it's just single digits the whole way down. It's like win, second, third, win, T10. It's all single digits. It's pretty.
Yes, though. Yeah. How far ahead he is, like in the world rankings. It's nearly back to what Tiger was when he was number one.
Yeah.
To me, shows, and you go through those four or five other players who, you know, since say 2010 have been quite dominant at times. And Scotty is at the moment. Now, when John Rahm was winning a lot or JT, the golf swings don't change. Like, Scotty swings it great, obviously, through impact. We can talk about balance and whatever else. But to me, when all those five or six players that you mentioned were at the top of their game playing great, I think it really identifies to me how good they are mentally, how good a place they are within their life. And I look at Scotty at the moment with Meredith and like how just happy, grounded, complete he is, settled as a person, settled. I don't know that, I'm not saying it's not his golf swing, he's got a great golf swing as John Rahm and DJ and all the players, Spieth, that you mentioned were quite dominant at different times. I feel that the biggest thing in his favour at the moment is just how settled and how, just you watch him play that last round at Augusta. Mentally, he's just so switched on, just thinking with great clarity, making perfect decisions.
Yeah.
And I think we know that with whether it's Lucas Herbert or you know, the golfers that are listening as a club player. Like, we all tend to play our best and we see the players, the elite players we work with playing their best when they're in a really good place. Mm. And I just, he's in such a great place at the moment.
Yeah.
That's really a really big reason to why he's basically dominating me.
It's, we talked about it yesterday. He's doing Tiger-esque things and we're all fortunate enough that we were around during the Tiger era. So we've watched that. I don't think anyone during the Tiger era really appreciated it until the numbers just keep adding up and adding up. Mm. And then you realize, hang on, guy is actually going to be the best of all time. I'm always cautious because we've seen this so many times recently. We've seen Rory come through and be so dominant and so good. And if we'd have sat here 10 years ago doing a podcast and talk about, oh, well, how about for the next 10 years when Rory's not going to win a major? You just wouldn't believe it. And Rory's settled. He appears to be, you know, all his ducks are in line. Golf is such a fickle, strange sport that the weirdest thing can just throw you off kilter and send you off on a different tangent.
Yeah.
You know, you've talked about JT, you've talked about
Victor Hovland,
Adam Scott, Victor Hovland. Mm. There's so many examples of guys who get to the top, and the corny phrase is that once you get there, that's when the hard work starts. And it just seems like Scotty, once he's got there, has found that niche, that area, that sweet spot where he should be. But, I'm not professing to know the future. Let's hope that continues.
Yeah.
But Scotty could start playing terrible in 6 months' time. Not terrible, but he could lose that spark, and he could, you know, in a year's time, he might be sitting here talking about how good Ludwig is and why he's so far ahead in the game.
Yeah.
The great thing about golf is that I'm not saying everybody can achieve that, but there's probably, you know, 10 to 20 players in world golf now that you could say, yeah, okay, well, if all this sort of clicks and goes the right way, then they could go off and be dominant in the game. Let's see how long Scotty keeps it going for.
And just to kind of tie, we can keep talking about it, but that thing about when you say Tiger-esque, and I think people forget as well how Tiger won his events at times. So, for instance, like what I've been used to seeing lately is, you know, in a major championship like at the Masters, right, where, you know, what we saw was seven people staying stale or coming backwards, and we saw one guy just going. He was like, I don't know why you guys are all struggling today. Why are you guys all over par? And he just went like that. And then that's what we saw with Tiger, right? It was always like, we got to the fourth round. Oh, someone's a chance here. And Tiger goes, not today, buddy. And then he would just go up here, and then they would just come back down here. And that's when we use the term Tiger-esque. It's the way that he's also winning some of these events. It's like, give him a chance, he's going to take it. But anyways, that was just something that's interesting. And I believe it's definitely got a lot of value in talking about it. Pee Wee, but actually talking about the Masters, what was that experience like with Herbie at the Masters?
Incredible. And again, I've been so fortunate, and I'm very sort of conscious of enjoying these sort of steps along the journey, because, you know, I'm the same as the rest of the golfing public. You know, you would get up in the middle of the night and watch coverage and watch Augusta and feel like you knew the venue before you even got there. So you step foot on the hallowed ground, and when you start walking the golf course, and so much of it looks familiar, and then in the same breath, so much of it looks so alien and so different because of camera angles and the way that they structure what we see on TV at home. It's a thrilling experience to then actually get to see behind the curtain and see how everything works.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful week. But then within the caddy circles, it's kind of a sort of inline joke that it's one of the hardest venues in the world to caddy at because of the change in undulations and because of the wind and how it swirls around some of these little corridors and stuff. You can see how at somewhere like Augusta, Ted Scott is just, you know, invaluable because he's won that event with, you know, multiple players now, and that each time you go back to a venue like that and you see how a golf course plays, it's so unique in the sense that it goes back there annually, whereas the Open Championship, you may only, if you're very fortunate, you may go back to the same venue on the Open roster, you know, twice, maybe three times. You're one of the, you know, real sort of legends of the caddying game. So I was very aware of trying to take it all in, trying to absorb as much as I could. Again, but there's only so much you can do within a week or 10 days or whatever it was that we were on property. So it does whet your appetite and make it so that you want to go back again and again.
You didn't get asked to change your high tops or anything by the people like Mr. Jason Day got told to take his vest off the other day, I saw.
I was very, very secretive, and there was a whole sort of process that went on there. I don't think anyone even knew that I had these sort of special sneakers made by some sneaker artist in New York. But to me, it was like, oh, what the hell? Like, it doesn't matter what they cost. I just want to turn up and because you're not allowed to sort of stand out, like you say, in the caddy world. You've got a white overall, a green hat. You know, you're absolutely, that's how you turn up. And yeah, I was very conscious. I think it was Thursday morning when I put on these sort of green and yellow high tops that I had specially made to, I was waiting for a tap on the shoulder. But maybe the golfing gods got their revenge anyway, because
did you stand out walking onto the fifth green?
Walking
first round.
Walking down the fifth fairway, the Augusta sort of ghosts of the past sort of got me because I slipped down and fell on my arse and slipped down this sort of, it was a really wet Masters, so the place was saturated.
Yeah.
As great a job as Augusta does of keeping the course playable, there's a few little soggy bits here and there, and yeah, much to my dismay, I fell and slipped on my arse, and my white overalls weren't very white for long. So Mr. Ridley maybe didn't catch up with me, but certainly the Bobby Jones, the ghost thereof, definitely tripped me up as I was walking down that hill on five.
The high tops look good, but not the overalls.
The white golf bag took a bit of a pasting as well.
Oh, that's so good. It's so, it does look a little slippery. You know, one of the major sponsors of this podcast is Back to Basics Putting Mirrors, talking about Grant Field. One of the designers alongside Richard Woodhouse, used by Cam Smith and the lot. Support the people who support the podcast. Link below, TM15, get your 15% off. What I believe is one of the best putting mirrors out there for you to use. You can fit it in your bag. The new model I'm holding up right here, people, on YouTube. A little bit smaller, a little bit more easier to kind of get around, and it's going to be a little bit more cost effective as well. So TM15 gets you 15% off. In the Back to Basics putting segment we have here, right, guys, is I'd like to get something from each individual one of you, and Dom's done this one, and we might start with Dom. Can you give me your number one tip or a tip around about putting or something that the recreational golfer or the professional golfer who's listening to this can take to use next time they go?
Pretty good timing, Toby, because I've been doing a lot of work with Karis Davidson. You know I work with on the LPGA Tour. Spent 2 weeks with her in LA and then Phoenix, doing a lot of work around tempo and obviously how that relates to speed control. Had a little tool, Blast Motion, that I put on Herbie's putter yesterday for the first time. It measures tempo very quickly and easily.
Yep.
Was it first 18 or 19 putts?
Yeah.
2.1 to 1 tempo every time. Like, it was phenomenal how consistently, you know, obviously that's measuring backswing time and matching it to time from top backswing back to the ball. And the consistency he had around his tempo and the time taken for that backswing to, and then backswing to ball strike was just so spot on.
I've asked you this before on this segment. What do you mean when you say 2.1 to 1, just for people listening, what do you mean about that? What does that mean? What are you measuring?
So your backswing time. Yep. So and this is, I always want to be careful with this. So rule of thumb in the golf industry, we talk about the time taken for your backswing. So it might be 0.8 of a second, right? And then the time taken from that backswing to get the club back onto the ball should be about half that, 0.4 of a second. Great. So 2 to 1, yep. Backswing to then backswing to follow through. So Herbie was 2.1. So he was basically, let's say, 82.82 to 0.38, yep, back to the ball. So slightly more. I was lucky enough to go to Scotty Cameron with Herbie a couple of weeks ago. I also went with Karis to Ping. We talked a lot about tempo with at both facilities. Talking about most good putters are between sort of 2 to 2.3. So Karis was up around 3, so yeah, really out of sync. Yeah. She was having a lot of trouble consistently controlling speed from, say, she'd be doing a good job Thursday and then by Saturday morning she's hitting them all a little bit too far past. So just that consistency around speed control. And that's where, you know, I'm doing a lot of work at the moment around just being very consistent with that tempo ratio.
Yeah.
And then if you create a lot of consistency there, how that ties into much better speed control day in, day out for your average golfer who's listening.
Yeah.
You know, from when they play on a Wednesday and when they play next Saturday, you know, sometimes I had really good speed control on the Wednesday, Saturday no good. Right, why was that? You know, did that tempo change from one day to the next? So, you know, that might help some of your club golfers that might be listening, is to really pay some attention to the ratio between time taken with backswing and then back to the ball, because if that's changing dramatically, you're going to really struggle with your speed control. And you add into that, obviously, uphill putts, downhill putts, speed of the greens change from day to day, you know, moisture, dew on the greens in the morning, up and into the grain, down grain. There's so many factors. Now, if you're adding another factor to that, and that's the speed of your hit, you know, you're going to be really struggling with your consistency of speed control.
How can, for the mere mortal out there that doesn't have the, I think you use Capto, how can they measure this? How can they measure their tempo?
I actually, the guys at Ping put me onto this Blast, it's called Blast Motion, and you can actually order them on Amazon, and that I'm thinking they're about $260 Australian, and it's this tiny little thing you put on the top of your putter,
mm-hmm,
sign up the app, Blast Bashio, I'm selling, you know, should be selling Grant's Back to Basics mirror, which
Dan
does use at the time. Great device. But, mate, because you're right, Capto we all use, TrackMan putting, there's all these great devices that measure this tempo plus a heap of other things, but they're thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
$260 Australian for this tiny little light thing that you put on the end of your putter grip, connect it to an app within 3 seconds, really, it takes that long, and gives you feedback around tempo. Now, it also gives you other feedback parameters, but I just use it for that tempo because I just think it's so simple, so important for you know, the average putter, let alone someone like Herbie. It was just really interesting yesterday when I put on Herbie's putter. It was just phenomenal how consistent, how good he was. And, you know, I wasn't surprised, but I was blown away. But just how good it was.
I've said it on multiple times on this. We've been lucky enough to be blessed with the two of the world's best putters, and they're from Australia. Cam Smith and Lucas Herbert. It's pretty crazy, right? It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, and I said to Piri, this little device, I'm going to give it to them so that if I'm not at an event, because occasionally Herbie will walk off, you know, a Saturday at a live event and he's like, I haven't putted great. You know, it's like, guys, put the device on. Let's just measure. And I think you'll find that, geez, you're a little bit hitty today, mate. Let's just get that tempo back.
Interesting.
So I noticed when Herbie putts really well, his speed control is so perfect because it's easier, obviously, to match to your read. You know, if you're reading a 10-foot putt that's, you know, right edge, well, that's only right edge at a certain speed.
Yeah.
So his speed's out fractionally. That's enough to leave it on the edge and lip it out or you know, break across the front of the hole depending on the slope, you know. So, you know, I'm always looking at things that I can have Herbie use that just, you know, keep him within parameters, make sure that he's always putting it really well. And for him, it's a lot of his tendencies when he doesn't putt great around his tempo, perhaps. You know, it's one of probably the two or three things that he can get a bit hitty. And, you know, this is just a device that I'm sort of adding into his training that's going to allow him more consistent around his tempo.
And calibrate himself. All right, Pew, when I switch to you right for the Back to Basics putting segment here for your tip, I want to ask you a question before we get...
Mine will be shorter.
That's okay. I want to discuss with you, Pew, and I've seen you do this, and I've seen you, I forgot what it's called, you use this kind of channel pyramid thing that comes down. Can you explain to listeners what this is? Can you do a better explanation of what I've just said? And I've seen some crazy videos of you doing it and it giving us different results.
It'll look like a little mini roller coaster for golf balls. It's a metal ramp is the best way to describe it. It's from a company called Perfect Putter in the US. And it's just a way of rolling a ball consistently. People use it for a lot of different things. I use it to find the perfectly straight putts, if you will. So on the putting green, I'm trying to set up, following on from what Dom's just talked about there, the reason why Herbie is so good at putting and the reason why he's only sort of weakness is the difference in his tempo is because his fundamentals are so good.
Yeah.
Because his stroke is so in ground. And the reason why it's one of the best putting strokes in the world and most repeatable is because of the way that he practices. So that's not by fluke. That's not, you know, just that he was gifted as being a good putter as a kid. It's years and years of brilliant work that Dom and Herbie have done to create this almost foolproof way of practicing. So yeah, I find a straight putt on the putting green.
Yeah.
We then construct what looks like some kind of torture chamber of tees where he has to use the putter to hit putts through this sort of channel, which your average golfer would look at and think, oh, that looks pretty difficult. They'd try and do it and the success rate would be zero. Like it's that difficult.
It's that tight.
But because Lucas has done it for the last 5, 10, however long you guys have been doing it for, it's the best way for him to practice his putting on a daily basis. So I use the perfect putter just to roll golf balls down. It has a laser attached to it and I can literally find the perfect straight putt on any putting green.
Can you share with me a story though on, so I want listeners, especially the recreational golfer, about how putting greens aren't perfect even on the PGA Tour. So you're uploading videos from, you know, let's call it Live Tour, the main tours in the world, and you're using this contraption, the ramp, right? And the ball's going down. Some of them are going in the hole, some of them missing the hole. How often does that happen?
That happens every single week. It doesn't matter where we are. It doesn't matter whether we're Augusta National or we're at the local Muni or wherever you are. golf greens are not perfect. They're not made of granite. There's a reason why when you go to ping and you do things on there, it's on a granite slab. That's the perfect surface. On a putting green, because of the way that grass grows, because it's so irregular and because it's a moving, changing, evolving surface, there's no such thing as a perfect putting green. Now, we've been very fortunate to go to some incredible golf courses, and there's some courses where your roll ball's down and four of them will go straight in the middle of the hole. The laser basically points at the middle of the hole. So as you roll a ball down, if the laser stays on that golf ball as it rolls down this sort of line towards the hole, you know it's a pretty good surface. But even the difference between, I remember setting up in Las Vegas as the sun was coming up, and you set up, you find this perfect putt, you roll some balls down it, and you go, okay, this is a straight putt. As the sun rises and changes position within half an hour or an hour, as that sun rises and changes, the blades of grass now sort of move and move towards where the sun is. So that putt now changes. It can change within a 10-minute spell. But even rolling four golf balls, you'll find that one golf ball will be rolling along the line. It'll hit a slight imperfection. That can just be the smallest blade of grass that's not growing in exactly the same direction. That'll knock it offline by point whatever of a millimeter. That now encounters another obstacle, which knocks it offline by another point whatever of a millimeter. Before you know it, that ball's missed the hole left. And then you roll the next one down, and that hits another chain reaction of impurities along that putt, and that one misses, you know, on the right lip. And that's the most sobering, the most humbling experience, is rolling golf balls down that perfect putter and realizing just how hard golf is. And we're literally just talking now about a 5-foot putt and how imperfectible putting is, for example.
Yeah.
Then you can start talking about hitting a 7-iron off a hanging line, a driver, and this, that, and the other. The game that we're trying to play and trying to control is literally the hardest, most imperfectible sport that's ever been created to man. So this is just like a microcosm, just a real sort of small environment example of how frustrating golf can be. Like, I'll roll balls down this chalk line, and every ball will go in the middle of the hole, and then Herbie will turn up, you know, 20 minutes later, or 20 minutes late, whichever one it happens, and he'll roll a putt that starts on the chalk line and then moves. And, you know, you kind of look at each other and scratch your head and go, how's that missed? And that's golf. You can put in the perfect ingredients and the shot will still not succeed. So,
but even hearing you talk about that, right?
That's shorter.
Marginal.
I'm not sure it was.
But just even hearing you talk about that makes me scared to hit my next putt, because I just know, like, what's the point? It's so funny because my father-in-law is a once-a-year golfer, right, or once every 2 years. He's actually just started picking up now. He's retiring. And he always says to me, golf, lucky man's game. He always says it to me always. And then when I see you do those videos, I go, man, I'll tell you what, he's kind of on a little bit here. But it just, when you kind of talk about that, right, so we're talking about the ramp and the ball going down, and I think it's mind-blowing for people who want to see this, right? I'll see if I can grab a link and put it down below in the show notes when Pee Wee puts his up, but then the ball just kind of rolls offline and misses the hole. One might go in, then one might miss, and we're rolling it from the exact same spot. Do you reckon there's anything here, Pee Wee, that's happening? Do you reckon there's a variance in the golf ball at all as well? Or do you think it's just the grass we're blaming here? Could we be looking at the golf ball not being perfect?
There's not a variance in the ball in the sense that, I mean, Bryson got famous a while back for putting his golf balls in Epsom salts and floating them and finding where the exact, golf balls in a certain way. I mean, geez, it depends on how deep you want to dive with this subject, and this is where my brain starts to go off on a tangent sometimes. But yeah, the dimple pattern on a golf ball, and as it's rolling down this surface, then yeah, it's not coming off that ramp exactly the same every single time. Now, when we initially, and if you can find this video, it's on Lucas's Instagram somewhere. It was a golf tournament called the Sanderson Farms Tournament on the PGA Tour, and it was a Wednesday afternoon. So to put that in some kind of context, the putting green gets more and more use Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday as that week progresses.
And later in the day.
And by Wednesday afternoon, everybody's trampled all over that putting green, and there's just footprints that you maybe don't see in the naked eye, but as soon as the sun sets, we've all played golf at sunset, and you look around and you go, geez, this looks like a cricket pitch. There's just
spiky
footprints there. You know, compared to, and again, I do this a lot, I'm at a golf course at sunup, when the greens look relatively perfect because they've been rolled and manicured and they're beautiful, And then I've also done these putting drills late at night when, you know, the sun's going down, and that surface changes immeasurably during a day. So that video you're talking about on a Wednesday afternoon, and I'm rolling golf balls down, one misses left, one misses right, one misses left, one misses right. The questions in the video were, oh, the caddy's spinning them, or he's putting kind of out effect, or he's using weighted golf balls, or he's doing this, that, and the other. Now, within a clinical environment, to get it absolutely perfect, yeah, you'd roll on a granite surface and you'd probably roll a ball that doesn't have any dimples on, because how those dimples interact with the you know, roller as it goes down.
Yeah.
All I can say is that it highlights how difficult the game of golf is, but also just how you're only responsible for, try and simplify putting in front of a putting coach, but you're only responsible for setting that ball off on the line that you've chosen at the speed that you've chosen.
Yeah.
And once it leaves the putter face, and in this case, once it leaves my ramp as I roll it, the rest of it's down to the elements. The rest of it's down to how good is the green, you know, what's it going to encounter along its journey. And that can be scaled up to when you've hit a 7-iron and what wind it's hitting and how it's landing and reacting with the surface. This game that we play, when you break it down into microscopic detail, is absolutely ludicrous that we expect the ball to go where we want it to go.
There are so many variables. I mean, wind isn't always exactly at 2 o'clock.
No.
Ever. And it's not always at 7 miles per hour. It's going 7-11 down to 6. And the angle's slightly different. And you see that 12 at Augusta is like...
Yeah.
Before I went to Augusta National, you know, I used to watch the guys, some land it in the garden bed over the green, then the next group, someone land it in the water. And you're like, how are they doing that? It's horrendous. Like, what are they doing? And then we went there and we flew one into the water and hit a perfect shot, because the wind through that section of course is just moving so much and changing in strength that it's like cutting that ball. All you can do is, at the moment, these guys are making the decision of what club to hit. Right, we're hitting this 9-iron, we're hitting a 158 shot, you know, and trying to land it at 143 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Once you do execute that, that's all you do. What happens in the air, wind, direction, up, down, whatever, you can't control. And it's the same with what Piri was saying about, you know, starting that ball on that line at that speed, that's all you can control. The variables in golf are what they are. And as a you know, golfer listening in, don't be hard on yourself that you've missed. You feel you've hit a really good putt from 6 feet and it hasn't gone in. You know what? You probably have. And that's okay.
Well, then you add on to that. We talked about the make percentage on the PGA Tour or the LIV Tour. And your average golfer that's out there playing with his buddies and he misses a 10-footer and he gets frustrated with himself. And it's like, you've actually done a pretty good job to get a 10-footer to even look at going in the hole when you think about the science behind it. You know, all the variables that are there. And then that's then, again, without being disparaging to the average golfer, but that's a guy who doesn't practice very often and whose stroke probably isn't that repeatable and probably didn't spend that much time reading the putt because he was too busy checking out the cart girl's tits or whatever else. So you look at what goes in, all the ingredients that go into making a putt, and it's like, it's kind of head scratching as to how guys make putts at times, you know, and then you put them in environments where they're putting for millions of dollars to win a green jacket, to win, you know, to win a pint of beer off their buddy. And to me, that's what's so fascinating about the game, is that you can deep dive into every facet, whether it be the perfect putter we're talking about there, you know, putting drills that we use and stuff like that. It's a fascinating sport, and that's what keeps us all in love with it over so many years. You never get bored of golf, I don't think. You might get bored of your inability to play it at the level that you want to, but I think it's a sport that, you know what, whether the PGA Tour, whether the LIV Tour, whoever the governing bodies are, whether we have an official world golf ranking, whether they roll back the ball, square grooves, this, that, and the other, whatever you change and whatever you modify within the game of golf, it's always going to bust your balls. It's always going to be the hardest sport you ever play, without sounding cheesy, one of these great life lessons. And if you can keep your head while all those around you are losing theirs, blah, 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 blah. Like, golf is such a microcosm example of how you deal with adversity and failure and success. And look, I've broke clubs over my knees. I've shouted obscenities when I've missed putts. We've all done it. But I think when you start to deep dive and understand some of the science behind what helps this do that,
yeah,
then it's an even more fascinating sport.
I love it. Well, one thing to add on that right before we close up the episode, you guys have been so great with your time. And one thing I love to share and one line that really hits well with me is like, I want you to try your hardest, but not care about the result. Simple. Like,
yeah,
it's such a great one to listen to, because what one to live by, because I'm going to try my absolute hardest at the best golf show I can. I'm going to go through all my processes to appear. I'm going to do everything I can to the best of my ability right now. And I'm going to do it and I'm going to perform and not care what's going to happen. And that to me is when I'm at my optimized in all my parts of my life. So I love that, people. I love that as well. And so to end up there on the back to basics putting segment there, you know, support those who support the podcast, TM15, get your 15% off. Link is below. I think a putting mirror is an absolute paramount to anyone who wants to improve their putting to, you know, Dom and I have used the term calibration. You just kind of recalibrate yourself, see exactly where you're at, because you can measure it, you can see it, and it's such a cheap and cost-effective thing. So yeah, it brings to the end of the back to basics putting segment. Hey, I want to shift a little bit here, right? I want to talk about the experience, because, you know, PGA Tour event, you guys go to the Butterfield Bermuda Championship there, right? Dom flies in with his magic potion, right? And gets everything working. As a team, you know, going into that last day, it was absolutely teeming down with rain, right? How far back was Herbie going into the last round there of Bermuda?
We were in the last group. I think we were 4 shots behind.
Denny Ann was there, if I remember. I think it was New Zealand.
It was Lucas, Danny Lee, and another. I've forgotten his name. He played President's Cup, and we were maybe 4 shots back, and he seemed like he played pretty well all week, but it was also he hadn't won on the PGA Tour either. Danny hadn't won on the PGA Tour, so it was a pretty inexperienced field. So it wasn't like you were trying to track down Scotty Scheffler. It wasn't like starting the last round 4 shots behind Scotty or Tiger or someone like that, where you thought, well, this is impossible, nothing's going to happen.
Whereas Patrick Reed was in the field, he showed up late, and he was the big scare. I remember with 3, 4, 5 holes to go, he'd posted a score. He was going up 18 and sort of was, one behind us or about what we were.
Yeah.
He was the one, because, you know, he knew how to win.
But, yeah, other than that, I mean, it was an unknown quantity. We didn't really know. I mean, yeah, the guys that were leading, sorry, I won't remember his name eventually. You know, he could have turned up and shot 4 under par and the tournament's over. But I think it gave you a sense on that morning of, or on the range warming up, that, hang on, this weather is absolutely brutal. Like, anything could happen out here today. It just made it a bit more exciting that, all right, well, maybe we don't have to go out and shoot 64 today. We just have to go out and just hang around the lead and see what happens.
Do you think that weather on that day played into Lucas's hands?
No question. I mean, I've caddied for a number of different golfers now, but I've also been around a huge amount of golfers, and I don't think anyone is as good when the weather gets really disgusting, you know, really pumping with wind and rainy. I mean, we won in Ireland in the same kind of weather. It was gross for a couple of days. It was wet and windy, and he just seems to battle down and show his true grit when the weather gets sort of really, really nasty like that. And his short game's that good. That
I was going to say, his short game, his putting, he's holding out. I mean, that's so important.
He held everything on the back nine.
Holding, you got so many par putts of 4 to 6, 8 feet in those conditions, and he's so good around that, you know. I think that's one of the big things. Yeah.
When you're following around, Dom, and you're kind of in that situation where, because golf is such a long, it's kind of like when I look at like the last round of a golf tournament, right? It's kind of like the start of grand final day, where like maybe the first few holes is just kind of like when they're getting up in the morning. You know, that's how long it kind of takes, right? When I think of grand final, like a rugby league day, it's like the back nine is maybe when the game starts, right? What was it like for you watching? When did you, like, because we put ourselves in situations a lot, and the old adage is that you got to keep putting yourself there and you might get one now and then. When did you really start to go, hang on, I reckon it's him or someone else here? Did you ever get that feeling, that kind of shift?
You're right, because winning's hard. You know, yes. Like, as you're in that last 5 on the back nine on a Sunday, you're not going to get it done all the time.
Mm.
But with Herbie that day, I felt pretty good. It's funny, as a coach, you know when they're pretty well in control of their game. You know, like I know he's putted good. I know he was good mentally. Like I knew that week that, you know, there was a lot of good stuff going on. And that day when the wind was like it was and the conditions and I could tell that he was embracing that and enjoying the challenge. And you look at some of the others and going, they don't want to be out here. They're not liking this. Mm. And, you know, I think, you're right, that whole last day, just ups and downs and, wow, we're in control. And then he makes this birdie and then Patrick's coming. And, I mean, yeah, it was a long day. But, you know, I think for me, I was enjoying that. Like, here I am, you know, at a PGA Tour event working with a guy that I've worked with for so many years. And, you know, you sort of pinch yourself a bit and go, this is what I've done the work for. This is part of the journey. Enjoy it and embrace it. And, you know, it's funny nowadays, even watching Lucas, you know, I don't get emotionally involved. And even a day like that, I mean, yeah, we want him to win, but I'm more nearly analysing what's going on, you know, just for the future, for ensuring that the advice I can give, the chats we can have afterwards are relevant and right and going to help him. So there's always my mind's always thinking not so much about the result but around, you know, just analysing everything he's doing, you know, technically and his body language, just so many things. So I think because my mind works that way, I don't get caught up in the emotion as much as probably I used to 5, 6, 7 years ago, where I used to walk around the golf course and, you know, miss a 6-footer and I'd like, the head would drop. I'm like, you know, like, come on, what am I doing? You know, that's not my job. That's not my role. Whereas now I'm like, he would never notice any change in body language or anything while I'm walking around the golf course because I'm actually doing my job. You know, I'm really looking at everything that I can take out of it because, you know, if I can just grab or extract one little thing that's going to help him for the next day or the next event, then that's why he's paying me to be there.
That's good. That's good. That's where we're different. Emotional roller coaster. Hey, tell me last hole before we tie a bow on the PGA Tour. I want to get into. I haven't even spoken about Liv yet. Tell me the last hole there, right, Pewee? What was the situation? And you took an iron off the tee, right?
No, I think we might have hit three. Oh, actually,
yeah, did. I'd
have to pull up my old yardage book, to be honest. We might have hit iron up there. Yeah. We went back there and played the last, this is fall, I'm not American. But we went there and played in the fall series and that whole place so different because wind direction and strength of wind and I guess situation as well. But yeah, you're right, we might have hit two iron off that. I remember we had gap wedge into the green and we were just trying not to spin it off the front of the green and we absolutely stuffed an iron shot in there close. But
what's your heart rate like at that time though, when you get to the 72nd hole in that situation? How are you feeling?
I think what's so great about, because we were on a real purple patch there. We'd won the Irish Open back in July. We'd finished fourth in the Scottish Open the following week, and then we didn't really figure in the Open Championship just because we were burnt out by then. But he was on a great, rich vein of form at that point. Yeah. So everything's just kind of clicking and everything just feels natural. It feels like that's what you should be doing.
Yeah, okay.
You'll go through similar spells where everything's going wrong and you just can't see a light at the end of the tunnel and everything you say, every swing you make, everything feels like it's not working. But then you've got to bring yourself back to those moments where, well, hang on, golf felt really easy there for that spell. Yeah, okay. So, yeah, it felt not easy, but it felt like everything was just clicking along and doing what you were doing. So there weren't a huge amount of leaderboards around and everything else, but I'm a bit like Dom in the sense that I get very, very absorbed in my own processes and my own job. Like I can't control the outcome. I can't control whether Patrick Reed birdies the last or Danny Lee chips in for eagle, you know, which did he make eagle? Almost did on sort of 17 and 18. So literally the only thing I can control is, right, as we're walking up that fairway on 18, I'm like, where's the sprinkler head? What number does it say on it? Let's get the number to the pin correct. How far uphill is it playing? Is the wind still doing what it was doing on the previous green?
Yeah.
You know, I've got a lot of boxes to tick from my own sort of process to get the information ready for Herbie.
Yeah.
So I keep myself that busy in that moment that I don't have time to look around and get distracted and look at a leaderboard and start thinking about winning. Like I think as a player back when I played, I tried to do that. I tried to absorb myself in the process, and it was a lot harder to do because you've got a lot more free time as a player.
Yeah.
Whereas I find caddying at that level, and I don't want to use the word easy, but it's there's less room for distraction if you're going through all your correct sort of processes and processes.
And so you were just so zoned in, you didn't really let it kind of overawe you, which is probably another attribute that's fantastic in that situation, right? The last thing Hobie needed was you seeing you can shake and getting the pencil out of your pocket like this here, you know, because I remember the shot he hit in the last there, and I remember I was watching it live myself. I think I was talking to Dom even during the tournament maybe, and in the rain, you know, hitting that knockdown gat wedge, it might have been to 15 feet, man. It was a good shot. I remember looking at it going, looking at it from my perspective going, that's a pretty standard shot. If I'm down the street, I hit that shot, I go, yeah, that's what I would do. But I thought to myself, put me right there and then, pissing down raid, 72nd hole, my first PGA Tour win. And I know I've spoken to Dom before about Lucas trying to get that transition from DP to PGA Tour event, trying to get that feeling of belonging and wanting to be on the, you know, winning on that best tour. Hitting that shot, and if you asked me to hit it, I don't reckon I would have even had the nuts to go and hit it. You know what I mean? And to pull it off, it just looks like a standard shot. But to me, I'm like, fuck, that is such a good shot that he just hit into that green there. And then obviously the rest is history. And then Lucas starts to feel at home and you guys get to go.
That's the difference between us and them, if you will.
Yeah.
Is the ability to do the normal in abnormal situations. And I've just butchered a phrase from Jonah there. But
I love that.
You know, every shot that you hit, the shot that Scottie Scheffler hits into the 15th, you know, hole at Augusta, it's the actual shot itself is never really the challenge. You know, these guys aren't trying to do things that they don't do on a normal daily basis. And sorry to turn this back and make this about me for a second, but
that's right.
That was where I always struggled as a golfer, was that I couldn't always do those things in practice. Yeah. So then I couldn't do them under the pump. Like if you're trying to learn new skills coming down the back nine of a golf tournament, then you're just not going to do those things that we're talking about. So, so Lucas, hitting that wedge shot to 15 feet, you know, in that circumstance, that is just what these guys can do. That's their skill set, and it's a normal execution of a shot in abnormal circumstances. And the less you can buy into all that that's going on around you, you know, which is easier said than done. But if you're able to just do what you're normally doing and not sort of treat it as an abnormal, as an extraordinary situation. Yeah. And that's why golfers have pre-shot routines. That's why you have a way of communicating. And that's why, like Dom says, theoretically, that opening drive on the first hole of a golf tournament to that last putt, you know, to win or lose a golf tournament, theoretically, you should be going through the same sort of thought process. But normal people can't do that. That it's not a normal thing to be able to perform under that pressure. So the rest of us look up and watch these guys do it, and we aspire to do it. But the truth is that, and this might sound cheesy, but they're wired up differently. Yeah. They're able just to put all that aside and for that moment go, no, this is what I'm supposed to do. Yeah. This is exactly what I do normally on the range anyway. And they're able to block out all that noise and that distraction.
Yeah, and that's, But people listening to this, right, is that, you know, Pewee, what I'm hearing Pewee saying that they can, it's still not easy though, right, is it? It's still like, not like, you know, I hear stories all the time of tournament players, you know, being able to go shoot, you know, 59 at the home course and then go to the next week and shoot 78. You know, like it's like far out. Like the blocking that out, and it takes a lot of, like he obviously saying he's working with a mental coach. He's working so hard at it all the time. He's got you on the bag. He's got a whole team to try and make that happen. And it's about putting himself in that situation and getting comfortable and learning on how to be there. Because I think, Pewee, you can probably help me with this one here as well, is that I say to people from my experience is that tour players have the same shitty thinking at time as golfers do. Like, I don't want to hit it over there. But they're trained to not, you know what I mean? Like they're trained to snap out of that. You know, they've still got the same stuff. Like, I don't want to miss this putt, or, you know what I mean? I don't want to shank it over there. Someone's standing there. It still crosses their mind. They're just like us, but they're just better at performing, don't you reckon?
Oh, 100%. If you hear some of the self-talk that goes on a golf course on any given Sunday at any tournament around the world, it would make the average Joe, the average golfer watching on TV feel an awful lot better about themselves. That's how professional golfers think sometimes as well. And yeah. I'm sure Scotty Scheffler's not walking down the back nine there telling himself that he's rubbish at golf and he's going to hit it in the water, but it crosses these guys' minds as often as it does everybody else.
Yeah,
they just have a better ability of knuckling down and either drowning out those thoughts or just acknowledging them and letting them pass by. And then they just have that ability to perform these great shots under you know,
and they don't get pressure. They don't get it right all the time either. I mean, look at the Masters field. Look at some of the players that miss the cut. And in every field, in every event, like they're not getting it right all the time. So, I mean, as club golfers, you know, a lot of the people listening, you know, how often do they play to their handicap? You know, is it one in six times? You know, how often does Lucas play great in an event, one in six times? Like they're not executing it all the time, week in, week out. I mean, there's, you know, for every, you know, Cam Smith finished sixth, was it, at Augusta? And people are talking about, oh, he didn't have a great week. You know, the players didn't play well. I'm like, seriously? Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, he played great. He was overshadowed by a couple that played even better.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a heap of players in that field in every field of every event, and Lucas comes into this too, where they don't execute it all that well. But we see what sticks out to us and what we've talked about in the last 20 minutes is examples of where they have done a really good job in executing their skills, the mindset, you know, everything they've learnt around that. But like club golfers, Toby, these best in the world, they have a lot of weeks where they're not playing great too.
Yes. Oh, mate, completely agree. I understand. I think, man, I think people need to see that too, right? Need to see that. And, yeah, I remember I used to work in a golf shop. I used to get the shits when someone would say something like, oh, what happened to so-and-so this week? He missed the cut. Oh, shut up, you idiot. You know what I mean? Like these guys, they're not he might have brought his B-minus game, but he's playing against the best in the world. You fool. You know what I mean? Like he's going to miss a cut if he hasn't got, if he's, you know,
either. You know, like the difference between your A game and your C plus game can be very little. And it can be 10 shots difference through two rounds or, you know, four rounds. I mean, the difference is so, so minuscule. And there's so many other factors. You know, did you get positive, negative variances? Oh, geez, I've got 8 positive variances that week and only 2 negative, whereas the next week you've had the other way around. I mean, there's so many moving parts to golf and your results and everything else that people just don't get and don't understand. But for us who are, you know, involved in it, there's just so much going on.
Tell me about, you know, we'll talk about the conversion to LIV now, right, when Herbie transferred his golf skills over to the LIV Tour. Did he take some time with this? I've had some conversations with Dom. Obviously, you can share what you can only share what you want to share, right? But when this was first floated to you, even you, Pewee, like what did you think?
It was very much I'm not going to think about it until it's, you know, an option type thing, because it was so far fetched that we were going to play on the LIV Tour at that stage. You know, towards the back end of last year, you know, we were still trying to cut our cloth on the PGA Tour and trying to find a way of, you know, getting into the signature events again, or whatever they're called now. Yeah. So LIV was just not on the horizon. And I think a lot of guys, and I was always a PGA Tour fan growing up, you know, as a golfer, and that was always the pinnacle of the game. And LIV came along, and I didn't really entertain it in the sense that, well, until we're playing on it, or until there's an option of us playing on it, then I need to concentrate on what we're doing. So it was very much, sort of a off the radar for me. I don't know about it for you.
Yeah, I think even Herbie and I have talked about it over the last, you know, last year and the year before, you know, and it was never something we really, Lucas, ever put much energy into. And I still remember the day I was down on the Gold Coast and Lucas rang me mid-December and sort of said that, you know, through management that he'd been reached out to, and, you know, he asked my opinion of, you know, what my thoughts were. And I remember Herbie saying, oh, you know, I don't think I'm very keen, because we sort of didn't. But we didn't know much about it. And I remember all I said to Lucas that day was, I think we should find out more. Let's get some facts around X, Y, Z, probably A, B, C, D, all the way down to about M, because it's a big decision. It's a life decision for you, mate. And I don't know enough about it to give you my opinion. You don't know much about it. So let's find out more and educate ourselves. And he was really good around that. And, and I think I had probably, three or four Zooms with Lucas and, you know, management and different people for probably a couple of weeks. You know, I don't talk to our school, but
yeah, of course.
He was really, I was so impressed with his maturity around just discussing it with myself and management and his family. And you know, you were involved a little bit with some chats. And I mean, it was a big move, it was a big decision. But I remember basically, you know, probably 2-3 weeks after that first initial phone call he made to me, he basically said to me, I'd be silly not to do this, wouldn't I? Because we'd found out enough, we'd learned enough, that even though I hadn't been to a live event, so, you know, I'd spoken to a few people. Pete Cowan had had a good chat to me in Dubai earlier about it. I'd recently read that Live and Let Die book, which you had, which had educated me a little bit. So, yeah, I think Herbie's process through that was really, really good and really mature. And, yeah, it just got to the stage, Toby, where it just made a heap of sense.
Yeah.
And looking back now, I mean, it's been phenomenal for him, hasn't it? He's I don't think I've seen him as happy as a person, as grounded as he's ticking so many boxes around his nutrition, his gym work, he's just happy. He's just, you know, it's been a really good tour.
Yeah, and from the outside looking in, from, you know, just about the perspective about making that shift and the difference, a lot of people as well. Particularly from Australia, because we are so far away from America, right? And the PGA Tour. And there's so much pressure on, you know, I remember when the new schedule came out that they brought out when LIV came, right? And it was this whole back-ended schedule and you got to play these X amount of events. Like Rory McIlroy got fined for not playing an event, right? I remember that like recently. And I remember John Rahm just going, that's too much. I can't go back to Spain. I can't go, you know, back to Spain to see my family. I can't play the Spanish Open now that I want to go playing because I've got to play in those events. You're making my workload go to so many more weeks a year. And it just makes more sense for an Australian as well who is so far away from, you know, home that they've got that opportunity to spend more time at home too, right? And still get to do what they love. And I don't know if I can put this into a little bit of perspective, but I'm pretty sure most people listening to this love their job, right? Love their job. But if they could just do their job for 20 hours a week instead of 50 hours a week, they would choose to do that as well. You know, and I'm not saying that's what Lucas did, but wouldn't you? You know what I mean? Like that's a way I kind of looked at it as well, where it was like there's a lot of pressure on these guys playing so many events on the PGA Tour. There's so many things that make it look attractive on my end.
There's so many factors, Toby. I don't think it's you can't narrow it down. And I'm not going to speak on Luke's behalf here, but I think there was just so many factors that were weighed into it that made his decision pretty easy in the end. And I think one of the things that Herbie, and when I say he was really mature, and I really liked a lot of the things he said through the time, was he's really big on Australian golf. And, I mean, you just look at what he's done last week. He's come home, he's played the Nyanga Park Pro-Am and shot 9-under or something and then played at Axdale and shot whatever there. And, you know, there's 300-400 people going following around a Pro-Am back in his hometown in Bendigo.
Yeah, so what Dom's saying, people, I don't know if it's actually even far out there, but Lucas just come back and played these Pro-Am events where in Australia, if I remember, the winner gets $1,700, right? You play, it's called a pro-am, you play with the amateurs, it's for these young tours. And for Lucas to come back and play in that, I don't even know what perspective I can put into it. It's like someone from the NBA coming back and just playing in your local basketball league. Like it's...
Yeah, I mean, but he loves, he sees, I think, again, I don't want to speak in his part, but not an obligation, but he feels great about himself putting back into Australian golf. I mean, he knows that, I guess, I remember him saying to me, you know, I'm not playing the signature or elevated events in 2024.
Yeah.
The Aussies they're not going to see me play on the PGA Tour. Whereas if I join Cam and Leash and Jonesy at Ripper GC, I mean, what that's going to do for golf in Australia, and we're going to see and experience it next week in Adelaide, so much more to grow the game of golf in Australia and for kids to watch and everything.
Yeah.
I really like that. I think because that was important to him.
Yeah. That's cool.
And I love that. Like he's come home, played every Australian Open, Australian PGA.
Yeah.
That's so important to him to do this sort of thing. Yeah. And he loves it. Mm. You know, I love that about him. He'll always do that. Yeah. And I think that was a big thing. Yeah, as I said, there's so many factors to why the decision was made. But I think for him, a big thing was what he can do for golf in Australia. And I think that's really important.
Sounds like a little bit more freedom too. Pewee, what have you enjoyed about going on to LIV? Can you share some differences with us, the listeners that haven't been to a LIV event or aren't involved behind the ropes? Like, what have you enjoyed about the difference?
I wish I could answer that without being on a podcast for you. God, I could throw you on the bus.
There's so many differences and yet there's so many similarities. Like it's still a golf tournament. Yeah. It's 54 holes versus 72 holes. But honestly, my job hasn't really changed that much.
Yeah.
The general day-to-day of turning up, walking around a golf course, making notes in the yardage book, you know, turn up, set up the putting drill, you know, cleaning clubs on a range, going out on the golf course, feeding information and interacting with Herbie. Like that, the bones of my job hasn't changed at all.
Yeah.
It's a nicer environment, and I'm not going to sit here and criticize the DP World Tour or the PGA Tour or even the Asian Tour where I started out. Like I've enjoyed every step of my journey, which has just been alongside other guys' journeys, you know, as professional golfers. So it's not that it's infinitely better, or it's not that the PGA Tour was really bad. It's just I had this conversation with someone this morning. It feels like the people that have organized and put LIV together have come from different parts of the world, different tours and different backgrounds, and they've all had the same quest and the same goal, which is how do we create the most enjoyable, the most pleasant working environment for everybody at this golf tournament? Mm-hmm. Not just let's treat the pros like royalty and the rest of you lot can just spend for yourselves, which is sometimes does feel like in professional golf, you know, we're all treated equally and extremely well at LIV events. And it's not, I think the downside to LIV investing all this money into the sport is that they're seen as just throwing money, you know, at a game, and you know, it's become about wealth and it's become about prize money and this, that and the other. But it's the simple little details of how well we're all treated when we get to a golf tournament.
Yeah.
You know, we're picked up from the airport, we're taken to a nice hotel, we're fed, we're watered, we're clothed, we're just looked after on a level that's so different to anything I've experienced in professional golf before. So that then makes for happier people within the golf tournament. So the pros are all happy because they're being treated nicely. The caddies and the support staff are all happy and sort of enjoying that experience. And we're playing at, you know, some great golf courses around the world in front of some great fans. So it's just been a really easy transition for me to make.
Yeah.
It was, you know, Lucas, I remember, called me up and said, you know, how would you feel about coming and caddying for me on the LIV tour? You know, almost like, would I be interested? And I was like, I'll caddy for you in the Himalayan Masters, mate. I'll go anywhere as long as we can go there and have some fun and play in a golf tournament.
Yeah.
The fact that we're playing for, you know, sizable increases in prize money and that kind of thing is a nice added on bonus. But if we were just playing for money and the rest of the experience was terrible, it wouldn't be anywhere near as enjoyable a job.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
and I think they've done that. LIV have tried to do that with a fan experience too. Like, I've noticed that. I mean, as a coach, mate, to go to Hong Kong, LIV, and have Grant Field there, obviously working with Cam Carter, with Jonesy, Dennis McDay, with Leash.
Like, it's like an Aussie catch-up.
Yeah. Can you imagine how good that is
as a coach?
Like, they're having dinner, breakfast, lunch, walking to the range, talking about different things that we're working on with our players. So the whole team environment has been really cool.
That
the
is
interaction
cool.
between the players, the coaches, the caddies has been really cool too.
Yeah.
But just that whole experience, that fan experience, like the hour before tee off is so cool. Like I didn't understand it and get it until I went to a couple of events, and like it's just the music, the vibe, the parachutes, the music, the same song. It's like it's like an hour before the AFL Grand Final, NRL. Well, everyone's sort of building up, and it's like this event's about to start. It's like that. There's so many
cool
aspects of that for a fan experience.
I think you use the word event too, right? Which is proper. It is an entertainment thing. But interesting enough, I was just kind of thinking there when Pewee was talking about just the simple stuff, right? Like getting your clothes, getting picked up from the airport, getting the hotels. And this is no different to playing in a professional sports team. Like when I hear what you just tell me, right, about all that stuff, it's exactly the same as playing in the Chicago Bulls basketball team, you know, whatever it is, you know, the Golden State Warriors. They get picked up from the airport, they get driven, they get their jerseys, they go to their, you know, they get looked up. It just sounds like that, right, where it doesn't have those extra, I'm not going to say maybe pressures or added extra little different things that you get at a normal PGA Tour event, right, and where you're kind of just fighting for yourself. It's like everyone's on the same team. And what has that team environment been like? Do you guys pay much attention to that during the event?
The team aspect of LIV has probably been the most eye-opening for me and the most enjoyable change, if you will. I mean, don't get me wrong, when you're caddying on the PGA Tour, when you're caddying at tournaments anywhere else in the world and you're looking at a leaderboard and you're seeing where you stack up against the rest of the field, that's important. That's what's paying the bills. That's what you're there to do. But then there's a second layer, and because the leaderboards kind of turn over quite quickly, so it shows an individual leaderboard, then it shows a team leaderboard. So you've then got a secondary interest. You've got like, okay, well, yeah, we're playing this good this week and we're in this position. How is the team getting on? Like what can we, if we're back in 40th place this week, can we make a couple of birdies to help the team climb from fourth to third and potentially, you know, get a podium finish? And it's very, very different. It's very, very new for golf. And I understand that that's getting a bit of pushback from some of the fans and maybe some of the doubters, if you will.
Traditionalists.
But I think when you get involved, and that sounds patronizing, but when you're on the inside and you're actually involved in the team, or if you're at an event and you're supporting a team, it's a very, very different dynamic. I think that team aspect of golf that so many of the golfing world are quick to write off and say, that's not how golf works. I said, well, no, that's not how golf has worked until now. Yeah. But it's actually extremely enjoyable to be part of a team. It's extremely competitive trying to have your team finish above the next team, whoever it is that you stood next to on the driving range, you know, that week. And it's a very intoxicating, very sort of addictive element of LIV Golf for me that you're trying to build a more cohesive and a better functioning team and trying to, okay, well, how do we work together collaboratively, you know, from a player, from a caddy, from a coach perspective? It's been a very, very interesting shift because, we play an individual sport. Golf always has been and always will be an individual sport. And this has introduced a whole different aspect to my career, to Dom's, to Lucas's. And it's actually, I think it would be easy from the outside to look in and go, but no one really cares about the team. But I can assure you that our first event in Mayakoba in and we're going up our final hole, and we've managed to sneak a look at a leaderboard. We're finishing on the 16th green, and we're playing 16, and we think we're in third place at this point. We're like, right, this is huge, right? We need to try and finish on the podium in our first event. And we hit it in the fairway bunker, and then we had a bad sort of, we couldn't get to the green, and like Lucas is grinding his nuts off to try and get this ball up and down from like 30 yards short left of this green. I don't know what place we were in. We were in 25th place or whatever, and the, there's a feel of, I want to get this up and down, but there was a whole added element of, right, I really want to get this up and down because I don't want to let Cam down. I don't want to let Jonesy down. I don't want to let Lee down. Because we've got a chance here to finish third. And that was a real eye-opener for me on that on the first green. On our first experience of, we actually need to hold this five-footer to potentially finish third. Lucas hold it, and there was almost like a little bit of a fist pump. I'm like, oh, yeah, great. And then we walked off and the TV guy who had a Rippers hat on, I think he was an Aussie, and he was like, oh, guys, you finished fourth. And we were mortified. We were gutted. Yeah. Like, oh, fuck. We just went down that ball. We thought we'd scraped a podium. So, the team element of it, and it just keeps growing and growing. And I can't wait to get to Adelaide because I think that's going to be times a million as far as support from the crowd. And actually, I think that's where LIV is sort of growing into now, is it will travel. LIV Adelaide is going to feel like a home game, but then there'll be other tournaments that will not necessarily feel like an away game, but it'll feel like a home game for Majestics or for
Footballs
or for, so you go into these places where those teams are more popular, and that's again introducing a whole different element. It's no different than going to Silverstone for an F1 race and everyone supports Lewis Hamilton. And, you know, you go to Brazil and everyone supports, you know, a South American driver. It brings a whole new element to golf that I think people are very quick to criticize and dismiss because we haven't done it that way before. But that's
pretty cool, isn't it?
That's the definition of just being stuck in your ways and not wanting to see progress.
And oh mate, if I'm in the company of someone who is criticizing something that hasn't been given a chance or heard the full story or completely understood what they're criticizing, then you're in the wrong company. Do you know what I mean? Like if someone just washes their hands with this, hang on, you don't even know. Just listen to it, right? Listen to what's going on. When we talk about the team aspect, right, every professional golfer in Australia, like who just plays maybe around the Australasian Tour or Pro-Am circuits that Lucas has went and dominated, right, they will tell you that they miss playing pennants for their golf club. They miss playing pennants for the golf course. And that's a fucking team environment, right? And what do I tune to watch every single year? President's Cup and Ryder Cup. It's a team. So one of the things with teams, right, is like what I'm witnessing and what I'm kind of hearing is in Australia, I love watching rugby league, right? It's what I grew up and I love it, right? I love it more than just my favorite sport to watch, right? And I love watching the clashes of teams that have got history. Do you know what I mean? So like last night, there was a big one between Roosters and Melbourne, which are probably the two biggest teams we've had in the last 10 years, right? Except for Penrith coming up now. And I knew I wanted to watch that last night. I don't support any of them. I was like, I want to watch this. Big clash, big game. These two teams, right, are going to go at it. Now, it might just take a while for Liv to, I'm not going to say create clashes and stuff like that, but to create these types of, you know, hang on, I'm sick of watching this team win. I want to see this team win. You know what I mean? So that takes time to build. You don't just get in love and fall in love with a team at first sight. You got to spend time to watch it and enjoy it. That's how I kind of view it, right?
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, and the whole camaraderie, I think being Aussies, I mean, it's been really interesting. We didn't know Leash, Jones and Cam that well, like sat low and whatever. But, I mean, the guys, the four of them, and the caddies and the it's been awesome. Like as Aussies, we just love supporting each other. And you see Cam and Grant and you know, Leash, everyone and the caddies, you know, how hard they're working. You just want to see them do well. And we feel part of that. You know, they've done a really good job of making us feel a really big part of that. And Herbie, I know, does. Like, he cares about that team big time. Like, we want to get the podium. We want to win, like, big time. You know, so I think the work they're all doing as Piri said, the team element has surprised me probably the most of everything that I've seen in Liv so far.
Guys, I appreciate you coming on. Hey, good luck. Is it 28th we're going to Liv, aren't we? I'm not going. You guys are going to Liv, right?
We're leaving Sunday down Adelaide next Sunday. So what is it, Friday, 2 days' time. We'll go and do some work with Herbie this afternoon. We're going to get a bit of rain tomorrow, Saturday, so it might be good to get down to Adelaide and get some better weather and, prepare. I mean, it's always nice as a caddy, you know, like starting on a Friday gives you an extra day as a caddy. It gives me an extra day as a coach once you get in there to do some work around short game facilities. You know, the greens are going to be like 13 on the stint down there. It's pretty pointless doing too much putting up here on the Sunshine Coast with the greens. So it's always nice to get in early and do some work, get his games, you know, prepared as we can for Friday's start. And, you know, there's going to be a lot going on next week, I think, for all four of the guys and the team. You know, it's such a massive – the build-up for Liv Adelaide's been really exciting, not just for Ripper GC, but, you know, talking to a lot of the other players on Liv, the couple of events I've done so far this year, a lot of them are really looking forward to Adelaide. Just shows that, you know, Australia, we probably haven't had the caliber of golfers and the events here for so many years. It's just, you know, what Greg's trying to get for our country, and you know, the way that the Australian public's supporting Liv Adelaide is just brilliant, and you know, we just can't wait to get down there and experience it ourselves, can we?
Well, it's going to be fun.
John Rahm said that when he asked everyone around, you know, management and you know, players, you know, the best event, and they all said Adelaide last season. Nice. So it's a really good attribute to Australia and South Australia, and we're extremely fortunate to have us in. And I actually think that, Piwa, you might have a little bit a bit more of a different job on your hands this week, right? You might have a guy who's a little bit emotional, wants to get a big win this week, being at home, and I'm sure that Herbie's going to want to play his best golf and perform his best his ability in this situation, because this is one of the main reasons he came, right, was to showcase his skills to the Australian public. And, you know, from the Golf Coach Podcast, people, the listeners, mate, we appreciate you guys coming on. And I know, Pewee, you don't do a whole lot of this stuff, so I really appreciate you coming on, mate. It was awesome to meet you.
No, thanks for having us.
Thanks, mate.
Cheers, buddy.
Well, that brings us to the end of another episode of the Golf Coach Podcast. If you loved what you heard from that guest, all their information is below. Be sure, if you enjoyed it, these people come out of their time. They take time out to jump on the podcast to help educate us and, you know, to offer us some insight into their expertise. Grab them on the socials below and send them a message. I promise you, they will absolutely love it. We love being told that things sound good because you don't hear much from people through the podcast forum. Remember, a podcast is released every single Wednesday, and if you love what you heard, please leave a kind review. They really help me go a long way to securing some big guests. It is difficult to try and, you know, sometimes grab these people, and if we got more profile with the podcast, we can get bigger and bigger guests to help educate you guys, and it's all for the betterment of the game. All right, everybody, take care. See you guys next week on the Golf Coach Podcast.